From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how to pick up an accent or how to lose one. We talk with speech therapist Sam Schwa. He helped actor Robert De Niro lose his Brooklyn accent and adopt an Appalachian one for the movie Cape Fear. Also today, how America's highway interests nearly killed off the railroads. We talk with Stephen Goddard about his new book, Getting There, The Epic Struggle Between Road and Rail in the American Century. And Maureen Corrigan reviews E.L. Doctorow's new novel, The Waterworks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has changed some of his top staffers around today at the White House. He's replaced his boyhood friend, Mac McClarty, as chief of staff, with Budget Director Leon Panetta. The president says the changes will add strength to his administration. He's praised McClarty for suggesting the changes.
His new role will permit him to spend much more time as my personal representative to the people who are so important to the success of this administration's efforts. Democrats and Republicans in Congress, constituent groups of all kinds, friends who helped to bring me to the White House. In addition, I am asking him to assume greater responsibility in shepherding our legislative program through Congress, including GATT, health care, and welfare reform, and to help lay the groundwork for summits this year with the Latin and Asian leaders.
Panetta will be replaced at the Budget Office by his deputy, Alice Rivlin. Mr. Clinton has also announced that Special Counselor David Gergen will stay with the administration for the rest of the year as a counselor on foreign policy. Mr. Clinton says Gergen will then return to the private sector. Meanwhile, Mr. Clinton's lawyers have asked a federal judge in Arkansas today to put off a sexual harassment suit against him until he's no longer president. Mr. Clinton's lawyer, Robert Bennett, released the request today. President Clinton is being sued by Paula Corbin Jones, who charges that Mr. Clinton, as governor, solicited her for sex in 1991. A New York Hasidic Jewish sect says it will have to find another way to educate its disabled children. The Supreme Court has ruled a New York school district created just for these children violates the separation of church and state. In another case today, the High Court also ruled for cable firms in Los Angeles. The justices say it's illegal for the city to prevent additional cable firms from trying to serve parts of L.A. The United States opens high-level talks with North Korea July 8th in Geneva. The new talks are in exchange for North Korea's promise to freeze its nuclear program. Barry Schwein reports.
There were two rounds of high-level talks last year, and they failed to give international inspectors full access to North Korea's nuclear sites. In fact, reconstructing North Korea's program could be difficult, even if North Korea agrees to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Valuable evidence has been lost. The Clinton administration is looking more to the future, hoping to keep North Korea from adding to whatever atomic weapons it may already have. The incentive is to dangle diplomatic recognition before the isolated regime, which could be a wise maneuver. North Korea also is going to talk to South Korea, so it could indeed be trying to break out of its isolation. Skeptics worry, though, about the ticking clock and what North Korea may be doing as the clock ticks. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 47 points to 3,685. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. The Senate Finance Committee has opted to go on meeting behind closed doors today. The lawmakers are starting work on one of several health care reform plans. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate Finance Committee Chairman Daniel Patrick Moynihan says he has not made up his mind whether to include some form of mandate on employers or individuals in his health reform bill. Moynihan is said to be considering a plan with no specific requirement on employers or individuals, but today he said it's a question of what will move a bill. Republicans and some Democrats on his panel strongly oppose any sort of mandate. The committee is considering plans that would aim to cover 95% of Americans by the turn of the century with market reforms, incentives for businesses that cover workers, and subsidies for those who can't afford health insurance. Today at the White House, President Clinton said lawmakers could push a bill through covering all Americans if there were less politics and more concern for health care. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A published report says the planned space station could run into trouble from space junk. The New York Times says the risk of a collision with orbiting debris is one chance in 10 over the space station's projected 10-year lifespan. But NASA says it can cut those chances greatly, perhaps to one chance in 20. NASA Administrator Daniel Golden says the agency will never be able to guarantee total safety. About 7,000 pieces of space junk have been tracked. Some pieces are as big as a school bus. The U.S. Forest Service says one of the largest wildfires in Southern California is now 50% contained. The fire has charred more than 2,000 acres in the National Forest that crosses Los Angeles and San Bernardino counties. It's destroyed 10 homes and caused millions of dollars in damage. Fire crews from neighboring states are coming to help. There's another big wildfire in Soledad Canyon that's burned 3,000 acres since Saturday. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Robert De Niro needed to learn a Southern accent for his role in Cape Fear, he worked with my guest, Sam Schwa. Kathleen Turner, Andy McDowell, Julia Roberts, Danny Glover, and Gregory Hines also worked with Schwa when their roles required accents. Schwa is a speech therapist and dialect coach. He specializes in helping actors learn accents and helping immigrants lose their accents. He's the founder of New York Speech Improvement Services. His accent elimination program called Speak Up has just been published in a book and cassette package. Schwa is from Brooklyn, but he lost his accent. I asked him to describe the weather just so we could listen to how he speaks now.
Well, the weather today is relatively humid and muggy, and the sun is out, but it's rather damp outside.
So how did you used to speak?
Well, I would say that it was more humid and it was more muggy, and it's not so comfortable outside, if you know what I mean.
Now, did you work at changing your accent, or did it naturally evolve?
No, I had to work at it consistently. I found that some of my clients were picking up absolutely the wrong cues from me, and they were walking out with a New York accent when I needed them to have no accent at all, what I call a standard American accent.
Now, I noticed when you first gave us the weather report, you said humid.
Mm-hmm.
And when you did it New York style, it was humid.
That's very clever of you. That's right. In this area, that H disappears before the Y sound. So instead of humid and humor and humidity and human, we have human and Yuma and humidity and humanity.
What are some of the reasons people come to you to either gain or lose accents?
The typical reasons people come to us is because they sound distracting from their content, that people are listening to how they're saying their words instead of to what they're saying. This could be deadly if you're doing a commercial. It could be deadly if you're giving a business presentation. And other reasons people come is because they find that they're stigmatized as being members of a discriminated subgroup. I sound too black. I sound too New York. I sound too Southern. I sound too German. Or they feel that parts of their speech make them unintelligible, difficult to understand, because most people are expecting standard American speech, which is an easier pattern for most people to understand.
Some of your clients are actors and actresses who need to learn dialects or accents for roles they have to play.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the most celebrated example of this was Robert De Niro, who needed to, I guess, lose his New York accent and pick up an Appalachian one for Cape Fear.
That's right. We worked very, very hard and long on that one, and he did beautifully in that in Cape Fear. We also studied together for him to replace his New York accent with a standard American accent in the movie This Boy's Life. And I also worked with Kathleen Turner and Isabella Rossellini and Tony Danza and Julia Roberts and Andy McDowell. Both lost their Southern accents with me before their movie careers took off.
Now, I'd like to play a clip from Cape Fear in which we'll hear Robert De Niro and Nick Nolte. And this is early on in the movie where Robert De Niro has come back to haunt Nick Nolte, who was his former lawyer. Robert De Niro has just gotten out of prison.
Okay.
What is the formula for compensation, sir?
Well, how about $10,000 in cash?
Do I...
Well, let's just break that down.
Wait a minute. You see, that figure just came to the top
of
the head.
Let's just say, for argument's sake, let's say 20,000, let's say 30,000. I tell you what, let's say 50,000. 50,000 to 14 years. 14 years times 365 days is about, I'd say about 5,000 days. Now, you divide that by 50,000, and that's like $10 a day.
That's not even minimum wage. To say nothing about the family that I lost, the respect that I lost.
I don't think you really, really understand what we're talking about here. 14 years.
It's Robert De Niro and Nick Nolte in Cape Fear. So what are we listening to there when we hear Robert De Niro speaking that's different from how he'd speak normally?
Well, what you're hearing is mostly vowels that are changed. For example, instead of a family, or as he might say, family, family, you are hearing a more nasal quality to the A in family, family. Instead of lost, which is what he would do for L-O-S-T, you're hearing more of a loust, loust, loust. Instead of the vowel I, which never exists in any part of the South, you have ah, the family that I lost, the family that I lost, instead of what I would say, the family that I lost, or what he would say, the family that I lost, the family that I lost. There's also very deep-chested vowels that come in there, and disappearing L's after vowels. Tell you what, tell you what, tell you what, instead of tell you what, tell you what. And the forced R's in the formula, and additional R's as at the end of that word, the formula for compensation, sir, the formula for compensation, sir, instead of what he might normally do, the formula for compensation, sir, the formula for compensation, sir. So these are some of the changes that we went through word for word through the script and all through the shooting in Fort Lauderdale at the time.
Now, listening back, do you think any New York-isms still seep into his Southern dialect?
Well, actually, yeah. I was sorry you brought that up. But when he says here and years, he's dropping those R's, whereas someone from Appalachia would force those R's and would say here and years. But that's about the only fluke in that passage. And he's so consistent through those lines that I don't think anybody would take him for anything but an Appalachian Southerner.
How did you work with De Niro? Spend like 3 months with him?
We spent 3 months before the shooting meeting, say, 2 to 3 hours, say 5 to 6 days a week, and all through the shooting in Fort Lauderdale with me tapping him on the shoulder between takes. And we did it spontaneously off the script in sample conversations. We called up department stores and asked for product information or product availability, and we went through every word of the script until he got every line down perfectly.
How did you find the right accent for him? As you often point out, Southern accents vary from region to region.
Well, they say that accents change every 50 miles because of the isolation of communities historically. There's been some leavening of that issue of accents overall with people's mobility over time and the influence of radio and television. But the way we identified this accent was we sat down and analyzed the videotapes of Southern prisoners, people who were put in Appalachian prisons for extremely violent crimes, men of about his age, white men of about his age, and we listened to them until he said, "That's the guy I want to sound like, that one right there." And we analyzed this guy's accent and saw how far De Niro's New York accent was from this. And we worked on sound replacements, where he would do one thing and I expect another. That's where we drilled for it.
You've also worked with Danny Glover, Isabella Rossellini. What did you do with Danny Glover?
He worked with me on the Saint of Fort Washington, and he needed a New York black accent for that role as a homeless person. And Isabella Rossellini needed a more intelligible Italian accent for commercials that she was doing for a cosmetic company.
What did you show Danny Glover about an accent in New York when he was playing somebody homeless?
Well, D's for TH's, like dis and dat and dem and does, and where we have ENs and EMs, for example, in Remember When, I taught him to do more of IN and IM, as in remember when, and features such as those.
Sam Schwa is my guest. He's the founder of New York Speech Improvement Services. We'll take a break and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is speech therapist and dialect coach Sam Schwa. He's published his Speak Up Accent Elimination Program in book and cassette form. Do you have any idea of how why Southern accents differ so much from, say, New York accents?
Oh, absolutely. They all derive from the original colonial patterns of speech. Depending on where those colonial immigrants came from, that's what caused the genesis of these accents. For example, in New York, Southern English people, say from the London area, settled and they drop R's after vowels. So whereas a modern Southern English speaker would drop an R after a vowel in words such as here and there and more and New York, the same pattern developed in New York where we also drop R's after vowels as in here, there, more, and New York. In parts of the Deep South, parts of Appalachian South, there was a Scottish-based influence where the bird R became diluted into more of a forced R that remains today, as opposed to the rest of the South, which borrowed from Southern England, and those R's after vowels dropped in different ways, as in here and there and more and New York.
When you listen to, say, news anchors on television, do you find that most of them have a very standard American way of speaking? Or can you detect regionalisms in their voices?
Well, you can always hear Peter Jennings' Canadianisms come out. But by and large, those people are chosen because they have pretty much unremarkable ways of speech. You wind up to listening to what they're saying and not to how they're saying it. And they're very good actors for the limited type of acting that they do. But the most important thing about those people, or people who aspire to those jobs, is that they have accents that don't reveal where they're from. Their accents are identifiably American, very easy to understand, and you listen to their content and not to their style.
You mentioned Peter Jennings' Canadianisms. I used to live in Buffalo, New York, and listen to Canadian radio a lot while mm-hmm. I was there. And I picked up what I think is a Canadian, instead of about.
Mm-hmm.
Is it typical for people when they live in a place with a different accent than the one they were brought up in that they'll just pick up haphazardly on certain things, whether they realize it or not?
Well, people are adaptable to different degrees. One fact that I'm sure of is that the bulk of your accent does develop between the ages of 3 years and 7 years, and it's based on where you grow up and among which peers you grow up, as opposed to your parents and what accents they speak. You can think about people in your family or people in your past who were brought up in Europe and have identifiably European ways of speech, and if their children were brought up here between the ages of 3 years and 7 years, their accents reflect the community they grow up in rather than their parents' accents. People are adaptable after that age, there is some plasticity, some changeability in people depending on how adaptable they are and how long they're in a particular place and how much they're resisting or trying to blend into the area.
You know, a lot of women now, especially I think younger women, have the problem of speaking in a kind of high, uncertain voice. And going along with that is often that the ends of sentences end as if they were questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if a lot of women come into your office asking you to help them deepen their voices or sound more assertive.
Mm-hmm. That's an increasing request that we hear at New York Speech Improvement. We hear people come in who say that they sound wimpy or they're not respected as much. This is men and women. But we're seeing increasing numbers of women, especially as women swell the workforce and women want to rise more and be in hierarchies and bureaucracies and be taken more seriously. We do hear this this rising sort of inflection that goes up as if they're questioning everything that they're saying or can be talked out of it. We're hearing habitual uses of higher parts of their ranges, and people do want deeper pitches, which are held to sound more assertive.
Are there exercises that you give people who want to deepen their voice and take it out of the nasal cavity and bring it back down into the diaphragm?
Oh, sure. In the tapes, we have all sorts of tonal exercises which will help you explore your overall range. We help you understand that all of your range should be used, but that some parts should be used more habitually than others. And we have exercises that put you in touch with your lower pitches.
Can you give me a sample of one of those exercises, help me kind of place my voice deeper down?
We can help you identify the more nasal range of your voice by speaking more through your nose, by forcing your speech more through your nose, and by comparing it with the most open-mouthed posture type of speech you can come out with. So, for example, instead of saying, my name is Sam, and I'm at New York Speech Improvement Services, we have you contrast that with, my name is Sam, and I am at. And we have you compare and contrast the feel and the sound of it. Usually what happens is that the feel is incredibly odd to the person as he's doing it. It does sound distorted, but we're looking for the greatest variation from your normal way of speech. Ironically, the nasal way, for people who speak nasally, usually feels best but sounds worst, especially when you're comparing it on a tape recording. And we have exercises that help you narrow the gap between the two so that you wind up with a comfortable way of speaking intelligibly with a non-nasal way of speech.
Say you were doing that exercise. How do you find the nasal part of the voice and how do you find that deep part?
The nasal voice is achieved by speaking with the mouth in as closed a position as possible, by keeping your teeth locked, gritted, and your lips parted to the smallest degree possible that will allow intelligible speech. So you can almost feel that my teeth are grit now and that I'm forcing my air, my voice out through my nose. The voice, remember, has only two routes out through the body. It can come out of the mouth or it can come out of the nose. It would rather come out of the mouth because that's the closer exit point from the voice box, from the voice box's perspective. The other voice is achieved by keeping your mouth in as open a position as possible, and you can even augment the sensation by putting your fingers on your sternum, your breastbone, and feeling that vibrate. It won't vibrate as much, or it won't vibrate at all while you're doing your nasal speech. And in fact, if you put your finger on your nose while you're doing that, you will feel more nasal vibration. So the goal is to have no nasal vibration and as much chest vibration as possible. It's what's called the difference between nasal voice and chest voice.
You have another interesting exercise to find the nasal versus the chest voice, and one is to keep your mouth closed and go,
Mm-hmm. Which is the most nasal sound you can produce.
Because everything's coming through your nose. All the air is coming through your nose.
Correct.
And then your nose really vibrates when you do that.
Right.
How can you figure out how to get a chest tone?
Well, you can do the vowel ah. With your tongue as flat in your mouth as possible, your mouth as vertically oval as possible, and your jaw as low as possible. We call it the dental vowel because it's the one that the dentist wants you to use. To say ah is about as non-nasal as you can get.
Good. So that should be useful in just helping people to locate their voice. You know, one thing I learned reading through your materials that you'd think I would have thought of before, but I actually hadn't, is that whether you're smiling or frowning will affect the way you sound. As you put it in your booklet, you can tell and the radio when somebody's smiling because their voice sounds different.
Oh, and they absolutely are smiling. There's a peculiar brain mechanism that's actually traceable to a part of the brain that controls vocal emotion, and it's right next door to those cells in the deep brain which account for facial expression. So if you manipulate your face, frequently your voice will change. One funny exercise that we have is we have people grin while reading into a tape recorder a bloody, bloody story, a really grotesquely bloody story from a tabloid newspaper, and then play it back. It's not even their language, and all they were doing was grinning while they were reading the story, and they will sound like the most psychotic thing going as a result on the playback. The purpose of these exercises in helping you use your face while you're speaking is so that you can reduce the monotone effect that some people have, where their voice is very, very flat. You can be sure that their faces are not being used much at all. And if we help them throw in a smile or some facial flexibility, their voices will sound more colorful and more interesting and more pleasing to listen to.
You know how some people have a phony smile?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a phony voice that accompanies that kind of phony smile?
Sure, because if the smile looks non-genuine, there's almost a sarcastic edge to the voice. As much as you can hear me sort of falsely smiling now while I'm speaking, there's a false pleasantness that comes into the voice as a result. And people who overcompensate by using those types of facial expressions while they speak, those people are also coached by us to look more natural and to sound more natural.
I know a lot of immigrants come to you wanting to pick up English accents or to improve their English accents. Is there a group that you're seeing most of now?
Being New York, we see lots of people with Spanish accents, Indian accents, Russian accents are on the rise. These are people who are trying with great difficulty to assimilate into American society. They want to sound like Americans, and they have a very firm idea about what American accents should sound like, and they want to be taken as Americans rather than as an immigrant group.
Let's look at the Spanish accent that you see a lot of. Are there particular sounds that people from Spanish-speaking countries have trouble saying?
Oh, absolutely. One of the sounds is the TH. Statistically, of all the sounds in this language, the one that comes up more than any other is the TH. If you distort this one, you sound different. And Spanish frequently substitutes a D or a T for these THs. For example, instead of saying these, this, them, those, they're more likely to say dis, dis, dem, dos. The Z sound does not occur in Spanish at all, and we have it quite frequently in words such as is, was, has, always, goes, please, which they pronounce routinely as an S. So they may say is, was, has, always, goes, please. We have a different kind of L from Spanish. So whereas I would say all and heel and aisle, they're more likely to say all, heel, aisle. And they will give a very nasal L to what we do quite non-nasally.
How do you teach somebody to change the L or change the TH? Just repetition?
It's a matter of teaching them to hear the difference, showing them how to produce the difference, showing them how it varies in different spellings, drilling them in phrases, and drilling them quite intensively in conversational speech, or teaching them how to self-monitor in conversational speech so that every time they hear it, they can self-correct, they know exactly what they're going for, exactly what they should be doing, and the more they learn to self-correct, the more they can rehabituate the way that they speak.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. You've made it very easy today.
Sam Schwa is the head of New York Speech Improvement Services. His cassette program on accent elimination is called Speak Up. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the fall, and now the rebirth, of America's railroads. We talk with Stephen Goddard about the highway interests that nearly killed off train travel and the traffic congestion that's helping to bring it back. Goddard is the author of Getting There, the epic struggle between road and rail in the American century. And Marian Corrigan reviews The Waterworks, the new novel about New York City in the early 19th century by E.L. Doctorow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has shaken up his staff. He's replacing Chief of Staff Mac McClarty with Budget Director Leon Panetta. Panetta will be succeeded by his budget deputy, Alice Rivlin. McClarty will become a counselor to the president. Special counselor David Gergen is moving to the State Department to advise the president and Secretary of State on foreign policy. Mr. Clinton says the changes will add strength and vitality to his administration. A new study suggests that one in four welfare mothers is addicted to drugs or alcohol. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
More than 1 million of the 4.2 million women receiving AFDC abuse alcohol or drugs. And among women between the ages of 18 to 24, the target group for President Clinton's welfare reform plan, 37% are chemical substance abusers or addicts. The statistics come in a study released by the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. The center's chairman and president is Joseph Califano.
The message is clear. If the administration and Congress are serious about ending welfare as we know it, then they must provide funds for the prevention and treatment of substance abuse.
The Clinton administration disputed the study, saying it finds a much smaller percentage of welfare mothers have debilitating drug or drinking problems. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Fisheries regulators say they may ban all fishing over a large part of New England waters for a decade or more. The dramatic move would be aimed at saving overfished stocks of haddock, cod, and scallop. Jennifer Ludden of member station WBUR reports from Boston.
A North Atlantic sanctuary would protect not only fish stocks, but also ocean habitat, which scientists say is being destroyed by the heavy nets fishermen drag across the seabed. Some researchers believe this has contributed to the steep decline in fish stocks. There is no formal proposal yet for a sanctuary, but a spokesman for the New England Fishery Management Council says a number of council members support the idea, which could be taken up formally within a month. A sanctuary proposal likely would bring stiff opposition from fishermen who already face severe new restrictions and who question the amount of damage their trawlers inflict. Currently, the U.S. has 10 ocean sanctuaries protecting various species and habitat. None, though, impose a total fishing ban. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden in Boston.
Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary has released a great deal of information about the U.S. nuclear weapons program. The previously classified papers include information about the number of nuclear tests the U.S. performed and the controversial government radiation experiments on humans. On Wall Street, stock prices recovered strongly from Friday's losses. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 48 points to close at 3,685. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The French government says that its mission to Rwanda is helping civilians there. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Foreign Minister Alain Juppé said the French mission in Rwanda has achieved its first objective by reassuring and protecting threatened civilians. French troops have been making incursions into western Rwanda from Zaire since last week. But the troops have yet to venture into territory held by the Rwanda Patriotic Front, which has warned it'll shoot French soldiers on sight. The Juppé said RPF opposition has now lessened since the French government has made it clear that its troops are only on a humanitarian mission. A military official in Paris said so far there have been no incidences on the ground, but he said the situation continues to be tense. He said France will have 1,300 forces in place in Zaire later today. Juppé said he hopes UN peacekeeping troops will arrive in Rwanda this weekend. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The dollar closed at a new post-war low against the yen today in Tokyo. The dollar ended the day at 99.3. That's nearly half a yen lower than its close last Friday. Japanese stocks fell, too. The Nikkei average lost nearly 466 points, or more than 2%. Traders say the dollar was quickly bought by institutional investors because they're apparently afraid of inflation in the United States. The recent troubles of the dollar are fueling worry that the Federal Reserve will have to raise interest rates to fight off inflation. President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore met today with African experts who are in Washington. Some 170 U.S. experts on Africa gathered for the White House Conference on Africa that opened yesterday. The experts are made up of a range of interests, including business, government, and academia. South African President Nelson Mandela spoke by satellite to the opening session. He's urged the United States not to give up on impoverished African nations, and he's calling on Washington to launch a massive economic aid package for Africa. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Trains are making a comeback in America, but our vast highway network nearly killed the railroads, according to my guest Stephen Goddard. He says the belief that the railroads merely yielded to a more advanced form of travel is a myth. In his new book, he tells the story of how the highway industry and the motor industry got the government to promote driving over train travel. He says it's a saga filled with high ideals and craven conspiracy, inspiration, and myopia. Goddard is the author of the new book, Getting There, The Epic Struggle Between Road and Rail in the American Century. He describes the highway and automobile special interests as the highwaymen.
The highwaymen have existed for approximately 75 years, and they are really an agglomeration of the automakers, big oil, the tire makers, glass makers, anyone who really has profits to be made from the sale of motor vehicles and highways. So in the post-war years, added to that were the hotel industry and motel industry, restaurants, fast food chains, anyone who could profit from this. They coalesced in the World War I era, and interestingly enough, railroads helped do themselves in because railroads had poisoned the well of public opinion by the depredations of the robber baron era, and so they and government were sworn enemies. This made it more easy for government to join hands with the highwaymen, and indeed this has been a public-private partnership ever since. And its essential strategy, which is very sophisticated and has been to sell to three generations of Americans the notion that cars and trucks are good and railroads are bad. Now that sounds very simplistic, but it's pretty on target.
So there was a partnership, you say, between people who built the roads and the government, whereas the government and the railroads were enemies earlier in the century. Why were they enemies?
They were enemies because from the very beginning, the railroads viewed themselves as the world's first big business. Consider that in the 1880s, their collective revenues were many times that of the United States government. And one of the reasons the government moved to regulate them is that this was an industry growing like a cancer, and they were afraid that if it wasn't stopped, that the railroads could take over the entire United States. Indeed, in the Western expansion, they practically created and owned the states that were settled out in the far west through the railroad land grants. The railroads, being the individualistic capitalists that they were, felt that any partnership or cooperation with the government would smack of socialism, and they were not about to have that. They didn't need government telling them what to do. They knew best. I don't think there's any question that the railroads brought on the enmity of the government. Even after the Interstate Commerce Commission was formed in 1887 and they began to turn the screws, it would have been possible for the railroads to say, okay, let's sit down and talk, maybe we can work something out. But they were always too proud and too arrogant and too individualistic to do that. And so consequently, the standoff continued.
Do you think that the design of America's highways was intended to hurt the railroads?
It wasn't intended directly to hurt them, although they were a necessary scapegoat in order for the highway motor complex to get the appropriations out of Congress and state governments that they needed. It was helpful to have railroads as, if you will, the bête noire, the enemy that had done damage to America. And indeed, if you look at the early years of the century, when magazines, the famous 10-center magazines, would run exposés, Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, people of this ilk, attacking the railroads. Many of these articles were funded by members of the highway motor complex, so that to say that the highwaymen intended to kill off the railroads is somewhat simplistic. To say, however, that they used the railroads as a scapegoat and to advance their own causes is more correct.
What was the railroads' response to the building of all the highways?
The railroads, incidentally, thought that the highways were the best things ever in the early years. Back in the teens, they crusaded, believe it or not, for good roads. Their theory was that if you could have smooth roads from the farms to the depot, it would help them speed produce, and they could carry more farm produce, which would give them more revenue. Even into the 20s, the notion that a trucking industry could arise that would challenge them was simply not accepted at all by the railroads in general. As early as 1916, some people within railroads, more visionary people, started smelling a rat that the trucking industry was going to be a potential competitor. But the conventional wisdom within railways was that it would never happen. A, cars and trucks were too flimsy. They were rather primitive conveyances at that time, and they could never go long distances. And secondly, the roads, even the newly paved roads, were bad. But what they had underestimated was that here the trucking industry was an industry of easy entry, where people could come in, and because they were their own boss, they would work in under hours and conditions that an employed person wouldn't. And so pretty soon, within a few years, they were going hundreds of miles, and the handwriting was on the walls that the railroads had a major and potent competitor.
My guest is Stephen Goddard, author of the new book, Getting There, The Epic Struggle Between Road and Rail in the American Century. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Goddard, author of Getting There. How does the American railroad system compare to European countries?
Well, first of all, the European countries have a long tradition of owning their rail systems. This does not mean that they were visionaries. It means that they did so for reasons of security back in the 19th century, because with enemies arrayed along their borders, a government could not take the risk of having their primary transportation system owned by private industry, and so they nationalized them. This gave them a built-in stake, Terry, in making sure that when highways came, that they maintained a balance with the railroads so that the rails would not be overwhelmed. As a result, today, the European rails are in much finer shape than we are, and they also are integrated with both road and air travel in a much closer way than we are. They work as one system, whereas our modes, air, sea, rail, road, work in a vacuum, one from the other.
What do you mean they work as one system?
Well, they are through, and this differs from country to country, but there's much more effort to plan the integration of the system so that you might see, for instance, in a European country, you might board a train in a large city, let's say Munich, and you go to Frankfurt, and you at Frankfurt you want to go directly to the airport and fly home to Kennedy Airport. Well, you put your bags in, you check them in at Munich, and you never see them again till JFK, because road and air work together so that, first of all, the train goes directly to the airport, which is a rarity in America, and then the luggage is checked over and heads home. Now, that kind of integration also exists more and more in Europe in freight travel as well. And that's one of the critical problems with America, is that the absence of that kind of integration creates a kind of inefficiency that puts us at risk in global competition, where the key is to move freight as quickly as possible from point A to point B.
What else do you think America should learn from Europe's trains?
Well, that passenger rail can pay, first of all. The French system, the TGV, particularly the one that goes from Paris to Lyon, has racked up a 15% profit in the 15 years that it's since it was built. And of course, this goes against the grain of the conventional wisdom that passenger rail can't pay. This is a luxury service. It's high speed, goes approximately 185 miles an hour, and with amenities that we don't have here. Now, fortunately, and I think your readers, your listeners should be aware of this, that the American rail system through Amtrak is going to offer the same kind of speed and convenience, well, not quite as much speed, but certainly the convenience and the amenities within about 3 years when they put on the Northeast Corridor from Washington to Boston a futuristic amalgamation of several European concepts into one American-made and manufactured train, which will go about 150 miles an hour and will have such things as hot meals on board and video consoles in the seat back in front of you, the kinds of things that Europeans have grown used to, and we're going to have it here.
In the earlier part of the century, you say that the railroads and the government were enemies, and everybody just really hated the railroads for acting like robber barons.
Yes.
But with Amtrak, there's a new kind of partnership now between the government and the railroads. What exactly is the nature of that partnership, and where do you see that in the period of history that you're writing about the rails and the roads?
The difference is, I think, that the government created Amtrak rather than the passenger rail system being a private entity.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they have a stake in seeing that it succeeds in the same manner that Europe has a stake, its countries have a stake in seeing that its passenger rail succeeds because they own the system.
So you think Amtrak has been a good development?
I think it's been a very good development. And it's going to get better to the extent that it can develop the volume it needs. Volume is everything to rail. And you're only going to develop volume when Americans are able to shake themselves loose of this cultural gridlock that says that they have to go everywhere by automobile and nowhere by train.
Why did you start writing about roads and rails?
I'd have to go back about 45 years, Terry, to tell you that. It draws together a number of threads of life experience. When I was a little boy in the 40s, my folks took me to New York on the early diesel trains in the days when you could have hot meals prepared on board in fancy dining cars rather than plastic pre-wrapped sandwiches as you often have today. Then in the 50s, as a teenager, I cruised the brand new interstates in my new car. Later, as a college student and newspaper reporter in the 1960s, I began to ask why the railroads and the trolleys happened to die at the same moment the superhighways were born. Then I really made a decision that I wanted to live in the cities, and I've been living in Hartford for 30 years. And as a husband and father and a person who works in the city, too, I've watched the legacy of the interstates, which were supposed to save the inner cities to bring in people to their downtown commercial centers. In fact, what happened was that they were a two-way street, and they sucked the stable middle class out. So that after all these years of asking these questions, about 6 years ago, I began to go back and try to find the answers, because I thought the conventional wisdom was that this started in the post-World War II era, and my big surprise was that it had occurred much earlier than that, back in the teens, and was the work of the highwaymen were organized even then, and the interstate highways today are something that was on the drawing boards back in the 20s and early 30s.
Well, Stephen Goddard, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Stephen Goddard is the author of the new book, Getting There, The Epic Struggle Between Road and Rail in the American Century. This is Fresh Air. The president has a new chief of staff. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, how are you going to cover that on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson is going to tell us what it all means. There's a new chief of staff, Leon Panetta, who used to be the director of the Office of Management and Budget. And so, of course, there's a three-way shuffle going on here. We'll also talk to a former advisor to presidents, Herb Stein, who says that not everyone agrees with the president's advisors that the dollar should be supported. Sylvia Poggioli has a piece from Gaza on what it's like living there under self-rule. And we have a piece from Cheryl Duval on the reunion of civil rights activists remembering Freedom Summer.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. E.L. Doctorow has a new novel called The Waterworks. It's about the Great Croton Holding Reservoir, which supplied water to New York City in the 19th century and stood at the present site of the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue. Doctorow's been haunted by a dark vision of the reservoir ever since his short story Waterworks, which was published 10 years ago in his collection The Lives of the Poets. Critic Maureen Corrigan says that in Doctorow's new novel, the reservoir is like Edgar Allan Poe's cracked House of Usher, a symbol of the evils floating free in society. Here's her review.
The Croton Holding Reservoir was one of those man-made marvels, like San Simeon or Mount Rushmore, that's so preposterous, it's creepy. It was built, if you can picture this, in 19th century Egyptian style, with temple doors and 25-foot thick walls that slanted inward like a pyramid. In the summer, weary New Yorkers could climb the reservoir and stroll along its parapet. But for the narrator of E.L. Doctorow's novel, The Waterworks, the view up there is far from soothing. From this elevation, the narrator says, the city seemed to fall back before something that wasn't a city, a squared expanse of black water that was, in fact, the geometrical absence of city. In The Waterworks, Doctorow has created a novel as mesmerizing and far-fetched as the reservoir itself. The Waterworks is obsessed with the bizarre, unlike most of Doctorow's other books, which have been grounded in a revisionist reading of American social history. This is not some postmodernist parody of a spooky story. It aims to be the real thing, a Poe-like tale of terror filled with mysterious stagecoaches, the walking dead, and desecrated graves. Here are the horror highlights. One rainy afternoon in 1871, a freelance book reviewer named Martin Pemberton turns up drenched and raving in the offices of the New York Telegram. He tells his editor, a man named McIlvain, that a few hours before he spied a white stagecoach filled with ghostly pale old men. Pemberton's curiosity was aroused, so he leapt on board and peered into the coach's back window. Inside, he saw his own dead father. When Pemberton later vanishes, McIlvain investigates and encounters the cryptic figure of Dr. Sartorius. He's a Dr. Frankenstein-like scientist who performs experiments on orphans in the hope of finding the secret of life itself. As Mary Shelley knew, the only way to pull off a story this outlandish is to tell it with utter conviction. Halfway through, however, Doctorow gets cold feet and begins to decode the demonic by turning his supernatural tale into a rational detective story. The genre switch made me feel a bit duped, as though I'd climbed onto the parapet of the reservoir only to find it had been drained of all that sinister black water. But all is not lost. One of the things The Waterworks shares with Doctorow's other great novels is that his sharpest social commentary lurks within passages incidental to the main plot. Here, for instance, McIlvain describes a boy's first trip into the urban nightmare of 19th century New York. The lungs of the young boy fill with the sickening air of the meat district, the stockyards and slaughterhouses. Perhaps he thinks he has landed not in New York, but on the chest of a monstrous carcass and is inhaling the odor of its huge, bloody being. It's the cumulative power of these blighted vistas of the city that matters most in The Waterworks. And looming over all is that malign image of the reservoir. After reading The Waterworks, you've got to wonder whether those two famous lions on either side of the New York Public Library may be doing more than just posing like feline bookends. Maybe they're also holding down the evil spirits of the past.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed E.L. Doctorow's new novel, The Waterworks. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Toohey, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. With Nancy Greenlee, Sue Spolin, and Kathy Wolf, I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Pope recently wrote a letter to bishops affirming the Church's ban against ordaining women as priests. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the theologian to the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, Father Gus De Noia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.